Jim Douglas is an American author, activist, and Christian theologian. He is a graduate of the Santa Clara University. He and his wife, Shelley, founded the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action in Poolsbo, Washington, and also Mary's House, a Catholic worker house in Birmingham, Alabama. He is the author of a number of books, including the 2008 book, JFK and the Unspeakable, with which we spoke to him, I guess, a couple of years ago. And most recently, Gandhi and the Unspeakable is his final experiment with truth. And Jim joins us now on the phone. Jim, thanks so much for being with us again on the Roadhouse. Nice to have you here.
I'm glad to talk with you again, Bob.
Are you developing a pattern here with your book? JFK and the Unspeakable, Gandhi and the Unspeakable, obviously both victims of assassination. Do you have a particular interest in famous figures that have been assassinated?
It's not so much famous figures who have been assassinated. It's the depth of evil that they were resisting, and the kind of evil that overcame them, and yet which they overcame in profound ways. It's a tension between a power of conscience, well, in Gandhi's case, what he called satyagraha, truth force, and the kind of evil that, well, in Kennedy's case, involved his national security state. And in Gandhi's also, it goes beyond what we want to think about, and certainly what we want to speak about. So it's the unspeakable.
And that's the evil that you're talking about.
That's the evil that I've gotten into exploring, mainly through Martin Luther King to begin with. He was the one I was first concerned about. But I wrote about Kennedy because chronologically he comes before King. Well, where did Gandhi come from? He just entered into the picture because I was exploring the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and I learned in the process that Gandhi was overcome by a similar kind of evil, and it involved state complicity. So I went to that almost by compulsion.
I believe I read, in fact, in the introduction to your book that this book was not intended to be a book to start out with. You were doing some research again on the assassination of, as you mentioned, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and then this way it found its way into a book. Obviously, Gandhi was, first of all, probably one of the more enigmatic figures that in history, and truly almost one of a kind, a great inspiration for a number of people, including, and as a strategy also, including Martin Luther King. Is there something about people who advocate not just nonviolence, but non-cooperation as a strategy for those that oppress them? And I apologize, this question is way too long. But there is something about them that society can't tolerate.
I wouldn't say that society can't tolerate, and that's, I think, underestimating society. I would say that it's something that very powerful forces, very negative forces, cannot tolerate. And so they're going to try to do away with these people, those kinds of forces, and that can be identified in various ways. You know, Merton did it in a very spiritual sense, calling it the unspeakable. You can try to pin it down more precisely by analyzing their deaths, and that's what I try to do. Mm-hmm. I think it's important. It's critical to name the unspeakable. When you name it, and when it becomes more visible, then it's less likely to be repeated.
Gandhi's life is so fascinating. When did he develop, when did he develop his, and again, you're going to have to pronounce it, but the truth force and his policy of nonviolence?
He developed satyagraha, truth force, love force, soul force. He used these as synonyms, and force is the common term in all of them. It's a power. He developed that in South Africa in the late 1990s, late 1890s, and the turn of the 20th century, when he was engaged in a huge campaign there for the rights of Indian people in South Africa. And he realized through what he called experiments with truth that through nonviolent action and through exploring the power of giving your life totally and nonviolently to the deepest truth that you needed to and could stand up for, there was a force there that was greater than anything like a weapon or anything like jail or repression. It could overcome anything. He was talking about a force that Martin Luther King said was at the heart of the universe, mm-hmm. and Gandhi felt exactly the same thing. So it involved a relationship with his opponents that was always one of love, respect, and in the instance where he died, of even bowing to his assassin.
Have you been able to determine in your study of Gandhi what kind of influence isn't the right word, and I don't want to use the word power, but the influence that he had with his followers, that he could convince them to take very, dangerous action in terms of physical harm, and they did frequently, both in South Africa and India, were badly hurt, and yet to do it nonviolently, to do it with regard of love to their oppressors.
Yes.
How do you influence people to do that?
He had a very simple power, the power that you and I have also. It's called the power of example. He gave his life to these forces that are within us all. They're forces of conscience. And they're forces of decision making. If you, for example, take your wallet out of your pocket, anybody can do this. Any listeners right now, and determine whether or not the money you have in it, or the credit cards you have in it, or the power that of affluence that you have in that wallet. If you can justify all of it, Gandhi could justify everything he had in his pocket, which was virtually nothing. He was totally free. He was totally free of the encumbrances that the rest of us have. And so by the simple power of example and of giving himself to what he believed most deeply, which coincided, incidentally, with what we do if we believe in anything that's at the heart of humanity or that's at the heart of a religion. If you give yourself to that kind of power, you can convince all kinds of people of all kinds of things, because they'll see that that power is incarnated, is embodied by your own life. That's what Gandhi had, his own life. And he summed it all up by saying, "My life is my message."
We're visiting with Jim Douglas, author of Gandhi and the Unspeakable, his final experiment with truth. You have been, as well as being an author, you've been an activist, a very active on behalf of nonviolent action. I'm assuming that Gandhi, not just in this book, but prior to that, has been a great influence on your life. How did you come to your belief in nonviolence?
Well, it was through Gandhi and Martin Luther King, but before either of them, Jesus. I'm a Christian, and my first really deep understanding of Jesus, though, so paradoxically, we're back to Gandhi, was through Gandhi. Gandhi lives out the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount in his life. Gandhi lives out the the meaning of the cross. He even said in a Christmas sermon that living Christ means a living cross. Without it, life is a living death. Gandhi would undergo any kind of suffering out of love for the sake of a new kind of world, a new kind of India. And Christians in his time came to him often because they were so attracted to somebody who was actually living out the teachings of Jesus. That's not because Gandhi was a Christian. He was a Hindu, of course.
Sure.
And that made it all the more powerful because he wasn't involved in any kind of hierarchical or dogmatic context. He was simply devoted to living as poorly as he could, as nonviolently as he could, as truthfully as he could, and that in that way he became terribly, terribly threatening to the powers of the unspeakable.
You know, it's very interesting, Jim, that someone who was as gentle,
yes,
nonviolent, to use the word very positively, meek.
Yes.
As you read about him and have read biographies about him, was way more threatening to the powers that be than people who were armed.
That is true, and that drove his main adversary, a man named Savarkar, wild, because Savarkar, who taught the necessity of terrorism, of assassinations, of revolutionary guerrilla violence, he taught these as a necessary way to overcome the British, and he lost power in doing that. This was the man that Gandhi debated in London, who was responsible for assassinations against the British from 1909 right through the beginning of the 20th century, and this man was driven to the point where he felt he had to mastermind the assassination of Gandhi because he could not match his power. But on the other hand, he accused Gandhi of destroying the power of India because he was convincing so many people of the power of nonviolence.
Right, right.
It was a huge paradox.
And reaching out to Muslims as well.
Yes,
yeah.
Gandhi was reconciling Hindus and Muslims. Savarkar wanted to destroy Muslims, and just as some Muslim forces wanted to destroy Hindus, so Gandhi was the reconciling force that was in his final experiment with truth in his final months, was bringing them together and overcoming genocidal forces, both in Hinduism and in Islam, and not in them per se, but in the distortion, a terrible, terrible distortion and manipulation of people through a so-called Islam or a so-called Hinduism.
One of the things that Gandhi did and is known for,
yes,
and on more than one occasion, particularly as India got closer to independence, was a fast.
Yes.
And first of all, why did he fast? Why did he use this as one of the strategies? And secondly, reading your book, when he would go on these fasts, a lot of the, again, very influential people tried to convince everybody, we've got to change the way we're doing things so that Gandhi will stop his fast. Why did he do it, and why did people care?
He did it because it was the deepest form of prayer he could carry out in his understanding. He wanted to empty himself, and he did that very literally by not eating, and even to the point of not drinking at certain stages of his fast, and of giving up his entire life. And the reason people responded so profoundly to that in ways that they might not have anticipated, or certainly did not anticipate they would, was that he loved them, and they knew that. He had such solidarity and affection, genuine affection for even the people who were most opposed to him,
mm-hmm,
that he could overcome mountains of adversity. And That's why other forces tried to stay distant from him. They knew that if they got too close to him, he'd overwhelm them with his affection.
Hmm.
The man who actually assassinated him, who pulled the trigger, a man named Goetze, he had tried to do it earlier and had failed a number of years previously, and Gandhi refused to prosecute him or want to put him in jail. He said to the police, just have him come and live with me for a week. That's what he wanted to do, and Goetze knew he better not do that, or that'd be the end of his continuous plotting under Savarkar, the main plotter, against Gandhi. So Gandhi was a person of love.
And that story, and there's others as well, where he literally, people who physically beat him, embrace them, and not just emotionally, but literally physically. When you say that we've got all of us have that within us, those stories make me wonder, because that just seems like such a huge amount of grace. But in the few minutes we have left, one of the ways that England ruled India, dominated India for so long, was to divide and conquer, to keep the Hindus and the Muslims at each other's throats. And then, of course, once they finally decided to give India independence, widespread violence broke out, and in fact, Gandhi went to a number of different places in India to try and make peace between the Hindus and the Muslims. And even some of the people who he worked alongside with for Indian independence, people like Nehru and others, really, I think they thought that, you know, maybe the best way is to have the Muslims have Pakistan and we'll have India and we'll be divided. But Gandhi didn't believe that and didn't want that. Why did he swim against that tide so strongly?
It was the heart of nonviolence for him to have Islam and Hindu reconciliation. It was the whole hope for India remaining united to have Hindu and Muslim reconciliation. And it was the key to India being a nonviolent catalyst in the entire world to have Hindu-Muslim reconciliation. He saw it as just profoundly basic to everything, and he gave his life for it. And he, I think, showed to us, and I'm talking specifically about us in this country right now, the United States of America, how necessary it is to reconcile with those on, quote, the other side. In that case, let's be specific. Osama bin Laden was the key to a new world for us. That's exactly what Gandhi would say. We needed to see him as a possible neighbor, as a possible source of truth. And of course, he would have been with regard to 9/11 had we chosen prosecution rather than execution. If we responded to Osama bin Laden, having identified his locale, in the way that Gandhi responded to his assassin, then we could have a new world. That's exactly Gandhi's teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to go there. That's the unspeakable.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's the unspeakable. That's exactly what Gandhi was willing to do. That's exactly why he was so overpowering in his vision. And that's exactly what we can do ourselves to create a new world.
The name of the book is Gandhi and the Unspeakable, His Final Experiment with Truth. It's author James Douglas. Jim, I first of all want to thank you so much again for being with us again. And also, the book was wonderful.
Thank you, Bob.
It's very, very difficult to put down. And again, appreciate you being with us.
Thanks so much. You're a great interviewer. It's always good being with you.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.